Oh my god, I hope that's a plane. Oh Jesus, please be a plane. Oh please. Mark Weezer, are you ready for this?
Cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular hit.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like
this. Suddenly, something else flew into the frame, fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Welcome to edition 442 of Strange Days Indeed, the first in June 2007. This week, our editorial contributor Dave Verlott, researcher and author of Strange Company, Military Encounters with UFOs in World War II, Keith Chester, and regular contributor commentator Alfred Lemberg. These are Strange Days Indeed. Why is it that Daryl Sims is still doing the conference circuit with what he claims are alien implants that have been examined by university people here in Toronto and pronounced to be not of this earth, when he knows damn well that none of the so-called implants are anomalous? Why is that, Daryl Sims? And why are the respected names in this field still sharing stages around North America with shysters and frauds? Why are the promoters of those events booking speakers who have nothing to contribute to the ufological body of knowledge? And why is it that those respected names aren't telling UFO conference promoters that they won't appear on the same bill with the shysters? Why do I have to ask these questions? Is the answer to all of them money?
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Verlott.
Just recently, an address was given by Eddie Bart, a Rhodes Physics and Electronics specialist, to a small group of academics, students, and residents of the Grahamstown Library Hall in South Africa. He started out by saying that the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is giving way to a search to keep the human race from extinguishing itself. He said that we have to give up searching for ET through the use of space travel because we can't get anywhere fast enough with our spaceships. He believes that the best way for us to get proof of extraterrestrial life is by picking up radio signals that aren't caused naturally. In other words, check out SETI, or the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Eddie Bart also said that Frank Drake's equation is the only way to estimate the number of civilizations in our galaxy capable of communicating with us. Actually, Drake's equation is for estimating the number of other intelligent civilizations that may be in the universe, not just the galaxy. And really, it has nothing to do with whether they can communicate with us or not. Mr. Bart finished his presentation by speaking about the impending disasters from global warming and pollution that might make us extinct as a species, and by stressing that most experts are pessimistic about us ever finding extraterrestrial life, and we should face the prospect that we really might be alone in the universe. All in all, nothing interesting in the presentation, and it might almost be considered preaching to the choir, except for a couple of niggling little facts. First, I have to agree with Eddie Bart that we don't have anything that can allow us to travel quickly to other solar systems or nearby galaxies. travel time is measured in hundreds or thousands of years with our current level of space-faring technology. But space agencies aren't searching for other civilizations or extraterrestrial life. All they're really doing is exploring space and our own solar system. Because, to be rather blunt, we don't know squat about even one-tenth of what's in space, even around our own sun. But Eddie Bart makes a statement that SETI is humanity's best effort to find proof of ET by listening for radio signals from distant planets or galaxies. Now, I believe that any effort to find proof of other civilizations beyond our planetary border is a noble thing. I honestly don't think we have discovered the best way to find that proof yet. I'm not convinced that aliens ever used radio or any other form of radio as a method of communication. I don't think that Marconi traveled to other planets in the universe, but, well, I could be wrong. Now, even if we look at our own world, we can see species using all kinds of different forms of things to communicate. Insects use movement, scent, and light to communicate things to other insects. Down in the depths of our oceans, there are fish that use illumination to communicate with other fish. In the air, birds use their calls to communicate with other birds. For us to assume that creatures not born of this planet would communicate with each other the same way that we communicate with ourselves is foolish. As for Drake's equation, yes. I believe it is very valid, and so would Las Vegas bookies. Matter of fact, I suspect that you would be able to find out the real odds of discovering proof of extraterrestrial intelligence by simply placing a bet on it happening in any given year. Or if you want to make a lot of money, place it on a particular month or day. When Mr. Bart finished his presentation by discussing that most experts believe we should be concentrating on dealing with pollution and global warming instead of searching for intelligent life, I would have to agree. However, I don't believe that we have to stop whatever efforts are involved in searching for proof of other life out there. As for being pessimistic about that proof and facing the possibility that we are the only intelligent life in this universe, I would disagree fervently. I'm a pretty vain guy, and I have been all of my life. I like to think that I'm attractive, but I'm not vain enough to think that humanity is the only form of intelligent technological creatures in this whole vast universe. Even our greatest religious leaders have suggested that God created not only Earth, but the entire universe, and could have created other forms of intelligent life within that universe. Mr. Bart's presentation said a lot of things, but there were issues that he did not touch on, and those issues are of consequence. First, no, we are not capable of traveling to other planets or galaxies, but that doesn't mean other races are not capable of traveling to us. Secondly, and most importantly, whenever we actually speak about other intelligent life forms in this universe, we have to address the subject of UFOs in one manner or another. I'm not saying that all UFOs are intelligently piloted vehicles from another world, but it would appear that even if only a minute percentage of those UFO reports were in fact otherworldly visitors, that in itself will eventually become proof that we are not alone in the universe. But that's just my take.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time, Strange Days Indeed.
Thank you, Dr. Sagan. Boy, the ripples from Contact, the movie taken from the novel by Carl Sagan, just keep on rippling outward, don't they?
Oh, it's just one of those things. It basically is tunnel vision. And I think that's what SETI is, tunnel vision. they close off every other possibility of being able to find proof of extraterrestrial intelligence. And by focusing only on radio signals, I don't know. I'm sorry. I really don't think we're going to see I Love Lucy coming from Jupiter.
And how long has SETI been searching for extraterrestrial intelligence using radio?
What is it, 30, 40 years now?
Well, it's been quite a while.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I bet you a bookie would be happy to take my money that SETI will find signs of life elsewhere via their radio telescopes.
Oh, yeah, in a heartbeat.
You want to how much? Oh, sure. Come on in.
Yeah. And by when?
I don't think that they're ever going to find anything.
No, I don't think they will.
And
either.
I'm not firmly convinced that they're convinced anymore that they will.
No.
It's become a lifestyle and a way of life and a way of making a living.
Yeah. For all they know, they've even admitted this themselves. They may have already discovered something and not recognized it.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, you mean they're not using FM?
And, oh, what do you mean they're not broadcasting in English?
Yes. We've spent a lot of time mocking SETI, but we're almost at the point now, with all the nonsense that's come out of Seth Shostak's mouth in the last few years. You know, if you don't know the answer, shut up.
Yeah, exactly.
And we keep repeating this practically every program, but it bears repeating.
It does. We can't have it just coming out and somebody saying, okay, there is no such thing as UFOs. We're concentrating on this particular area, and that's how we're going to find extraterrestrial life. It's like, what?
And this Bart man, his comments are almost as fatuous as that scientist who said, well, they couldn't afford to travel here. They don't have American Express? It would cost too much to travel here.
Cost too much to build it.
And who was it who said, all anybody with a computer will ever need is 64K of memory?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That was Bill Gates.
Yes,
was. Yes, yeah. 64K of memory. God, I don't think I ever had a computer that only had 64K of memory. Going faster than 7 miles an hour in an automobile is potentially bad to one's health.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, especially if you hit something. All of these scientists, all these men of wisdom, in single quotes, who had no business saying what they were saying, but because they were scientists and had letters after their name, were accepted as gospel tellers.
Yeah, it's like bumblebees. According to the laws of aerodynamics, bumblebees cannot fly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess nobody ever bothered to tell a bumblebee that.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It makes me bananas, and I know it makes a lot of UFO researchers out there bananas, but that's just the way it is nowadays. And nice compliments for Paul Kimball after you started the ball rolling on this program a couple of 3 weeks ago.
Well, very, very well-deserved compliments, I might add.
For Best Evidence, his new documentary.
Oh, yeah. Out of everything that I have seen, and I've seen quite a bit, the best tales of UFOs and yada, 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 Paul's was the most professionally done, didn't present it with any particular bent on one way or the other, wasn't trying to convince us of anything, was basically presenting the facts and say, you figure it out.
And I'd rather think that David Cherniak's two-hour special for the History Channel will be the same.
I hope so.
It's going to be interesting. And we're not that far away from that airing up here in Canada on the History Channel, and I bet elsewhere on the planet, too. I think it's set to run in September, but David will correct me. He listens to this program and will correct me immediately, I'm sure.
If not, sir.
He's got my phone number.
What
yes.
Was that beep I hear?
Oh, nothing. It's my watch telling me I have to take my medication. Well, as usual, Dave Ferlott, a splendid take. Dave, you just finished a screenplay.
Yes, I did.
And that's why your website isn't functioning yet.
Yes, because I was busy trying to get that finished off and printed.
Good. We can look forward to seeing your website up soon.
Yes, most. most definitely.
And remember you said that.
I will.
Program 442, folks. He said that in.
Yep. So that means I've got to get my butt working so
yes,
that for the
do.
Next one. It'll be ready.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to it. And thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
We shall talk to you next week.
For sure.
Bye, Dave.
Bye-bye.
War II would grip the world with terror for 6 years, and during that time, military personnel reported seeing numerous highly unconventional aircraft in all theaters of operations. Those objects had extraordinary flight performance capabilities, and they came in a variety of shapes, sizes, and colors, and were able to travel at extraordinary speeds and avoid radar detection. Keith Chester has written a book, Strange Company, Military Encounters with UFOs in World War II, and it's the first in-depth account of unconventional aircraft observed and reported by the military during World War II. The book includes the reactions by military commands, their viewpoints and theories as they struggle to make sense of the observations. Joining us on the line from his home in Maryland is author-researcher Keith Chester. Keith, welcome to Strange Days Indeed.
Thanks a lot, Errol. I really appreciate being on.
And I appreciate you coming on. We seem to have turned into a program of much ufological history of late, and quite obviously your book contributes a lot to that UFO history. Let me ask you from the outset, as I almost always do with all our guests on this program, what got you interested in UFOs?
Well, in 1989, I was researching a crash and retrieval case, and I wanted to find out if I could get some type of help in the field, someone who might know more about that particular situation. So I contacted Leonard Stringfield, and he was more than willing to help me out, so he became more of a mentor of sorts. And so he helped me with the case, and after that was over, we became fast friends and spoke quite often. And during that time, I decided I wanted to actually learn more about the World War II sightings due to his. So in 1991, we decided to begin the project, and I recorded his observation. And from there, I just decided I needed to do some serious research.
You've been involved in all of this for a fair while, presumably.
Yeah, I conducted research at the National Archives in College Park for around 4 years. And I knew that I had to really find out what was available beyond UFO documents from Project Blue Book. And researcher historians Jan Aldrich and Barry Greenwood were very helpful in getting me on my feet to find out exactly what was available, what was some of the best documentation. But I didn't want to just use that. I wanted to go in and find what they had and start fresh. And that's what led me to being there so many years.
Many people who've started out in this field started out under the wings of both Jan Aldrich and Barry Greenwood. And it's been good for the field, I think, for not only their work, but the work of those that they've nurtured.
Absolutely. They're great guys. And through the years, I really appreciate their comments and their help, and they're such a value to any researcher that they'll definitely be considered some of the primary sources that will help us with a better understanding of the UFO phenomenon, for sure.
Just as a side question a moment, you said you had interviewed Leonard Stringfield. Did you actually make recordings of those interviews?
Yes, I did. I made some crude recordings at that time. It's hard to hear him. I have enough that I got his sighting. It was basically just his sighting, as most of the researchers know it. At least I have his voice on tape now. But our many other conversations, no, I didn't. They were all over the board, and they were candid.
I'm sure you know that Wendy Connors has a one-woman organization called Faded Discs. She has been gathering UFO-related audio for years and has quite a staggering library and has been putting them out as MP3 files on CDs.
Yes, I know Wendy, and that is one aspect that has fallen through the cracks. I need to get her that recording because it is of value to researchers and the history of the field.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing I need to provide her immediately now that I can come up for air.
Yeah, and she has the technology now to clean up clips quite well. So no matter how bad you think your recording is, I think by the time Wendy has finished with it, you'll be amazed at the quality that she's managed to pull out of it.
Yes, I've heard some of her work, and it's incredible and very valuable. I've used some of it before, so this is great.
When did you start writing Strange Company military encounters with UFOs in World War II?
I started in 2003, and I went through several drafts. There was still little known, and I had to assemble all the cases, and I had to go through the documentation and find out what I had to tell a story. I wanted to tell it more story-like, that in the vein of Kehoe and Ruppel type of storytelling, it was a little bit more interesting and less dry. And so I wanted to make sure I had a story there and going through the documentation. So it took me quite a long time to finally get it narrowed down and fine-tuned.
Your book is released as of the end of last month, May.
May 29th, yes. Mm. Anomalous Books. And Patrick Weege has been a fantastic help, and I can't convey that enough. And it has a foreword by Jerome Clark.
Patrick Huige has been another godsend to this UFO field. To wander off for a moment, I first became aware of Patrick when he was writing UFO articles for Omni magazine back in the mid-90s.
Yes, absolutely. I didn't put the names together until I started talking with him, and yeah, he's been around for quite a while.
And has since gone on to run the Anomalous website, and I think that's with Dennis Stacy, and now a book publishing company.
Yes, it's fantastic. It's high quality, and I'm very, very happy to be with them. They've helped me quite a lot putting this together and helping me along the way in areas that I wasn't sure of, being a new writer. They made sure that my manuscript was clean and, you know, could read well. I can't say enough about him, though, as far as helping me along. Jerry Clark's been fantastic also.
And a prolific author, researcher in his own right, Jerome Clark, too.
Absolutely. I only aspire to try to get to that level of expertise in writing. It's like they were the peers who I was looking forward to trying to at least be able to say that, yes, they accepted the work and it was something worthy that might be part of the UFO literature.
So your book starts in 1939?
No, it actually starts in the early 1930s, because there were sightings that were pretty significant that were reported in the papers, the Scandinavian sightings of aeroplanes, that what they called then, phantom flyers, ghost aircraft, strange lights, shafts of light seen throughout the world. And what was unique about them was that as the papers reported them, countries like Sweden and Norway were beginning to conduct investigations because there was a real concern that though they felt they were aircraft, they were still beyond the technological standards of aircraft of the day. So there was much confusion. And even during their investigations, they couldn't figure it out. So it just carried on into 1939 when the war started.
What were the descriptions of those pre-war objects that were seen?
Most of them were lights. And you will find that John Keel did some extensive research. He called them narrow aeroplanes. And in his articles, there were a few cases where there were actually ships that were observed, and mostly lights throughout, you know, areas. And in rugged areas and places where storms were occurring, they could hear them. In some cases, they actually could hear what sounded like an aircraft. According to authorities, they weren't supposed to be able to fly in such conditions, and that's what started really causing the military to have a lot of concern. By 1933, Hitler had come to power, so there was a great concern that these were aircraft that were used to probe boundaries of the nearby countries for invasion, but that was a few years off, and even at that time, Germany's aviation industry hadn't, to my knowledge, been able to produce aircraft that could travel such long distances in such severe weather for such a long time.
Were there unusual flight characteristics to those pre-war objects?
As far as the aeroplanes, which would be the ghosts of aviators, the Phantom Flyers, they were the characteristic that was the most unusual was, of course, the bright light.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, there was beams of light that shone down from them. But as far as incredible flight performances, I don't recall that much being reported, other than it was just a light. It appeared to be an aircraft and moved around and over areas that were long distances from any known airport. Then around the world, at around the same time, there were other odd things, such as shafts of light, which looked like long swords in the sky. People would see hovering over Brazil, over the United States. So you're starting to get a feel that some of these objects were not celestial, and they were apparently within the atmosphere, so that's what caused a lot of the concern.
I guess there were actually many, many documented instances of those sightings, many reports.
Yes, around the world, absolutely. And what's really lacking is a real sense of just how many sightings were occurring around the world because of archives not being available to us. But I think if I was able to go to every country and amass the documentation available, it would probably be astounding that what was occurring during those years.
That must have been one hell of a task to get into, particularly with the pre-war stuff. Did you find a lot of that online, or was it a matter of having to write letters to various archives, newspaper archives, and ask for information?
Well, basically, I tried to start with the good UFO literature, and then I tried several archives with historians such as Dick Hall, of course, Jan Aldrich, Barry Greenwood, and communicated with other researchers. And I was limited to actually traveling to an archive. And so I picked the National Archives in College Park because it was within 2-hour distance from me. And I decided for me to really get a feel for what was there, learn how to utilize and access the tremendous amount of files that exist, I had to get to know the staff. And by doing that, I was able to really start to maneuver. And I only really had scratched the top of the surface with this. The documentation is so immense. I literally could spend the rest of my life there looking at documentation. And that would only be the documentation that the National Archives has cleared for public access. Alone, there is thousands of documents that have not been cleared by the National Archives of Air Intelligence Matter during the war itself. And I'm suspicious what might be in there. There may be nothing in there of significance, but it's interesting, it's still classified.
Yes, and one has to wonder why, after all this time, it's been 60 years now.
Yes, it's been 60 years, and actually, because of 9-1-1, the archives took a major hit. The Air Force came back in, Department of Energy came back in, they started to classify much of the documentation that was released, which was ridiculous because some of that same documentation was available at presidential libraries. So I don't know if they went to presidential libraries. It's almost a laughing matter, but in my personal experience, I had used the Freedom of Information Act and gained access to some of the classified records. And not long after 9-1-1, the Air Force came back in and they pulled those boxes and I wasn't able to go through them. So because of 9-1-1, the government has really clamped down, and I asked about that and they said, yeah, even if they mentioned intelligence or nuclear or atomic or anything, it was immediately reclassified because I guess terrorism or who knows what, but in a lot of cases it really didn't make sense and it really really upset about it at the archives as far as that policy.
It would be interesting to find out, in fact, if presidential libraries have been slapped with secret classifications as far as presidential papers are concerned subsequent to 9/11. And with the latest move by Bush to make all of his presidential paperwork unavailable, all of it, for many generations to come, one has to wonder what is going on in the background as far as documentation in the National Archive, documentation in the presidential archives, and why it's going on.
Absolutely. It's a big question and a big concern because we've had to step back now and we've lost ground because of the new war on terrorism. They're going to use that as a vehicle to reclassify and keep things completely out of public domain, which is disturbing and in a lot of cases unnecessary.
Let's go back to the Second World War and the start of the reporting on unconventional aircraft.
When the war broke out, Bomber Command, British Bomber Command, were reporting strange observations of aircraft with lights. It would be like a fighter aircraft with maybe a searchlight. But yet, in some instances, they just couldn't account for it. I couldn't identify it. So by 1940, issued a report that the pilots were probably reporting things that just weren't there or just misidentified due to stress. And that was our first indication that they were confused and puzzled by the phenomenon itself. They weren't calling it a phenomenon at that time. I think in August 11, 1940, Bomber Command did release a report called Phenomena Connected with Enemy Night Tactics. And they called some of those sightings peculiar incidents. I don't know to what extent and how many reports existed. A lot of those reports don't exist now in the archives in Britain. But as far as I know, they did start, as the war began, accumulating these type of reports.
On last week's program, we talked with David Clark, who had described the disappearance of many, many documents relating to aerial phenomena out of the British archives.
Yeah. From my knowledge of working with the archives in College Park, sometimes the documents are missing. But it's because it was poor organization or they were actually microfilmed possibly and the hard copies were destroyed and those microfilms are now stored within another records group or with another facility. So you have all these chunks of time missing, reports missing, or that, like at the National Archives, they are classified top secret to this day.
Yes.
We're not too sure exactly.
That's what David Clark was saying, was that documents were misfiled or had either incorrect or, as far as researchers are concerned, misleading titles, so that unidentified aerial phenomena could possibly be filed away with something else. And not deliberately, but it was just, you know, human nature.
Absolutely. In late war, it got to a point where a lot of phenomenon sightings were listed as jets. So my biggest task was to determine in the intelligence memoranda what they were really talking about. Were they using the term jet as a catch-all phrase? In a lot of cases, I believe they were, because, of course, air intelligence was telling the pilots ME-262s, 163s are now in service. So when the men started seeing strange lights at nighttime, conducting maneuvers that were unexplainable, in a lot of cases in the beginning, they were reporting them in their reports as jets or light or appearance like a jet. So here again, you can see how the problem, since the term UFO did not exist, flying saucer didn't exist at that time, all these different types of names were being used depending on how the pilot described them, or in some cases how the unit commanding officer wanted them listed in the report. From my research, I learned that some of the unit commanders absolutely refused to use crazy terms other than jet or light or flare. They did not want to use anything that was considered confusing, which I don't understand at all.
They might have jeopardized their careers.
Absolutely, or they had some type of order to actually water down the reports or keep it at, just like in the post-war when the Robertson panel met, how try to play down the reports, explain them away, because there's definitely evidence that the pilots were being shaken and unnerved by some of the sightings. They were so extraordinary. Unfortunately, the most extraordinary sightings don't exist in the archives. That's where the big blanks are. But when you speak with the veterans themselves, you have to say, well, this is such a tremendous account. And he says it was reported, and it affected him for the rest of his life in terms of it was astounding. Where does that report exist? And then you go to the particular mission reports that do exist, and there's not even a mention about it. So already we can see where there was some type of behind-the-scenes attempt to funnel the more extraordinary reports to higher commands and levels, because there were definitely investigations being conducted.
Which I guess really brings us to Foo Fighters, because they seem to have been the predominant reporting, particularly in the later stages of World War II, when the Allies were flying bombing runs over Germany.
Absolutely, and one of the interesting things about Foo Fighters, and I include myself, when I first started researching, I assumed the sightings during World War II were called the Foo Fighters. But I soon realized that, of course, that was a term applied to the sightings, which were called a night phenomenon by Schaeff Command, that had to do from about the month of November 1944 to February of 45, a very small period of time. And that particular name was given to the objects by the 415th Night Fighter Squadron, an American Night Fighter Squadron, based in France. At the time, they named it after a Smokey Stover cartoon at the time, where the Foo-mobile, the fire engine, was a comic they followed. So they, I believe, Foo is fire in French, and so they call them the Foo Fighters.
Feu is the word in French.
What is it?
Feu. Yeah, it's F-E-U and pronounced feu, rather than fe or foo. But that's the mispronunciation.
Yes.
Volai voco shai. Yes. I have read many reports of bomber crews, and specifically gunners on bombers, warming up their machine guns on the Foo Fighters, attempting to hit them, and apparently hitting them, but absolutely nothing happening to those objects. Or the Foo Fighters appeared to be lit, and the gunners were using tracer ammunition, so you get a line of flight of the bullets. These things would duck out of the way.
That's absolutely true. I think the first account, the most famous account, occurred in June of 1942. Ray Roman Sabinsky was a Wellington bomber coming back from a mission over the Ruhr Valley in Germany, and he's over Holland, and that occurred. He saw a copper-colored circular aircraft that, about the size of a full moon, approached the aircraft, and two of his gunners opened fire on it, and the tracer rounds could be seen going into the object but not exiting. Mm-hmm. And there was no effect whatsoever. He reported that, and he knows other crews saw the same thing because he had heard that they had reported on the way in the same thing. So that started it. So, yes, there are many reports of encounters all the way through the war.
Coincidentally, Keith, I have a recording courtesy of Wendy Connors, who first played it on Strange Days Indeed a couple of years ago, a recording of Major Raymond Sabinsky.
Correct. That's where I got my information.
Aha. So you've heard that clip.
Absolutely, yes.
Well, let me play it for the listeners now, and that'll help those that haven't heard it.
In 1942, in June, I was flying bombers, Wellingtons, over Ruhr, and dropped the bombs on the target. And on the way back, my rear gunner reported an aircraft approaching from the rear. I told him that if this object comes too close, then we'll have to open the fire on him. My idea was that perhaps it was a German fighter aircraft equipped with a searchlight in the nose. When this thing came close, I wouldn't take any chance on it, and I told my rear gunner to give him a blast. Then he opened the fire on him, maybe 200 yards. And at that distance, this object was almost the size of the moon, which was also visible at the same time. We used the tracers in the machine guns. There are four machine guns in the rear turret. Those tracers would just enter, and that was it. That lasted for possibly, I don't know, maybe 2 minutes. And after that time, this shining object suddenly changed the position and at a terrific speed moved over to our port side, almost at the same distance, about 200 yards from the wing. And then it stayed there. Of course, then rear gunner and the front gunner opened the fire on my order, and I could see the tracers entering the target again from under two angles, at which I was sure that this was pretty close to 200 yards then, because you could see the angle crossing the tracers. After a while, it took off at a fantastic speed, at least 45 degrees angle, and it just disappeared between the stars.
Major Raymond Sabinski, pilot of Polish unit, the Royal Air Force, reporting a June 1942 sighting to Herb Clark of the Vancouver, British Columbia Flying Saucer Club back in 1961. And our thanks to Wendy Connors for providing us with that clip. To your knowledge, have there been other recordings of pilots who had encounters with the Foo Fighters?
I'm aware of some. I don't have any verification. I would be surprised if there weren't. Unfortunately, there's a lot of researchers behind the scenes, and a lot of us don't know each other.
Yeah.
And so my task over the last several years was to try to find out exactly what was known, and I'm far from finished. It's so comprehensive in terms of just how much is going on behind the scenes, but it wouldn't surprise me if there were many more.
Your book, Strange Company, Military Encounters with UFOs in World War II, covers the Foo Fighters. Were there any other phenomena that were observed during the Second World War?
Well, there was, of course, the Foo Fighters was one name. The British called them balls of fire, and that particular term was used by them in the European theater, and then in the Pacific theater, the American Air Forces picked that term up, and they were calling their sightings the balls of fire. The Pacific theater was a very unique realm because they were a little bit different than the balls of fire in Europe. Other names throughout the war that I'm aware of were the light, the thing, meteor. So there were many names, and then of course, like I said, the term jet or flare was used as a catch-all phrase or term to describe a lot of the phenomena. That a lot was ordnance-related. And I think that by now many of your listeners are aware that September 6, 1943 and October 14, 1943 sightings over Stuttgart and Schweinfurt, Germany, there was a disc phenomenon, first reported, I believe, by Frank Edwards. That disc phenomenon truly was disc-shaped objects, but soon proved to be ordnance-related. However, among that disc phenomena is where we have to be careful, because there were people seeing disc-shaped objects, and of course they were assuming, due to the Air Intelligence reports, it was part of the ordnance being observed. Flying donuts is another term they used.
Were there incidents of solid-bodied objects being seen, or were they all nighttime balls of light, Foo Fighter type visuals?
No, there were daytime sightings, and some of the more famous accounts, of course, was Leonard Stringfield on August 28th, but that was, I guess, phosphorescent type of glowing object. But there were incidents where the witnesses observed shiny silver metallic looking craft in Pacific theater of operations, European theater of operations, wingless objects, that they knew they were seeing an object, at least, and they assumed it wasn't a type of aircraft. But in a lot of those cases, they maneuvered in such ways, and their speed was so great, it was very frightening or confusing to the observer.
It was not only the Allies who reported these things, and a lot of the powers that be within the Allied commands assumed that it was some sort of secret technology that the Axis forces were flying. And presumably it went the other way, too, where Nazi Germany and Italy and Japan all thought that it might be the Brits or the Americans or any of their allies flying new technology.
Absolutely, and that was a big situation with Air Intelligence Command. They realized that Germany was far ahead of us as far as aerodynamic technology. And they knew there were lots of projects in the works, from the underground and from captured POWs and captured citizens just reporting in the field. And yet the Germans were seeing objects also. And I have very few actual accounts. In one instance, in 1942, a Zeppelin-like disc-shaped object was seen over Moscow by Russian troops. And that was a daytime sighting that the craft was maneuvering in the air and very slowly and then shot up in the air what they estimated to be thousands of miles per hour. They couldn't believe it until it disappeared. So there were these objects seen around the world by the Japanese, the Germans, the Italians. It was a worldwide phenomenon. And also, by the end of the war, Germany was exchanging technology with Japan. They had throughout the war, but there was a large effort near the end to send U-boats to Japan with the top scientists, experts, blueprints, actual examples of jets, rocketry, you name it. And there were interrogations conducted. And one of the questions on a 20-question put together by the British Air Force was the Foo Fighters, Balls of Light, over Germany, and they were actually interrogated the crews of these submarines about this, because obviously there was a real concern that, yes, we know Germany is advanced, but there's still these sightings that do not correlate with how far in advance they were with their technology. The book also really covers an undercurrent of the air intelligence gathering missions, which I feel were very, very important, and an apparatus that probably holds the key to a lot of the information that is missing. And I discuss that in the book. So once the book gets out there and the reader really gets acclimated to what I have to say, then I'm sure many, many questions will arise.
Do you get the feeling, as we wrap it up, Keith Chester, do you get the feeling that there has been a deliberate cover-up of a lot of the aerial phenomena reporting that happened during the Second World War?
Yes, I do. The longer I research, the more I thought there is a possibility that Project Sign in 1947 was really just an extension of an investigative operation going on with the phenomenon. And I believe when it first came out, it was called Project Saucer for the public's information. I really believe that was nothing but an extension from the war time investigation. And by the time Project Sign started, I believe they had quite maybe small scale, but at least some type of investigative operation in process.
And of course, Project Sign has been covered in various books and magazines over the years by various authors and researchers. So we encourage the listener to go and ferret out what they can about Project Sign, either online or in their local library. I don't think they'd have any problems finding that information.
Like I told you, there's such a tremendous amount of material that has not even been looked at.
Yes.
I was going through files that literally were falling apart in my hand that had never been seen since they were put in the box in the late 1940s.
Oh my.
So I know for a fact people were not looking at this stuff. So it's just a tremendous amount sitting down there. There's so many archives that need to be tapped. I'm like, wow.
And especially now in this day and age where people would much sooner do their research by reading, you know, Project 1947 or Current Encounters or UFO Updates or the various so-called UFO websites that are out there.
Absolutely right. And you have to be careful with the websites because you have to find out where they get their information.
Yes.
And I found that I had so much on my plate, I didn't want to have to do that, so I really, really stayed away from the net as much as possible. Mm-hmm. I think I used it twice in the book for information, and that was regarding things like radar.
Yes. Yes. Well, I mean, there are, you know, there's Project 1947 that one can trust, and the NICAP site.
Right, right.
Because they're put together by people who know what they're doing and know how to sift the salt from the coal.
Exactly.
Yes.
And again, many of the sites I couldn't use because we were talking post-war information, primarily. Jan and Barry are the only two that I'm aware of in KUFON who have any kind of documentation posted on World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And then a great deal of it, was it just sits in their archives in hard copy form. And that's another problem with, like I said, fortunately I got to know a lot of the researchers and those two. What they did, they sent me what they had, which wasn't a lot. And I realized, oh my God, there's not much here. It's primarily the 415th Night Fighter Squadron. Of course, that's late 44 and 1945. So while I had that documentation, I still went in and tried to find everything they gave me to verify that maybe they didn't miss something and just to have a hard copy for myself to say, yeah, I actually looked for it. So I kind of went in with the attitude to put the blinders on, see what you can find and go where you think you should go to find documentation. And I did uncover documents that were never seen before. I did uncover a document that verified Dr. Robertson of the Robertson Panel was conducting an investigation on the Foo Fighters. And I have that memo coming from Schaaf.
So what happened to the documentation that he put together?
That is missing. And one of the key people in World War II, the foremost authority was Dr. David T. Griggs. And if you recall the Robertson Panel report, when they mentioned the Foo Fighters, a very brief mention, that they said the most knowledgeable, though investigations were being conducted by Robertson, Dr. Luis Alvarez, and Griggs, they said Griggs was the most knowledgeable. And Dr. James McDonald interviewed him in 1969. And he filed reports. He made reports of the Foo Fighters and the Balsa firing in the Pacific. And all of that is missing. All the key documentation. But I was able to find a whole slew of documentation that came out of Schaaf discussing what they called the night phenomenon. So I've included that. I guess that's some of the most pertinent information. Though it's not saying anything we don't know, but it, at least it shows there was something high level going on. And they didn't know what it was. They were confused.
Well, pretty much the way most people are today.
Oh, no, look, it's a seagull. No, no,
exactly.
It's a pelican.
There's so much in there I haven't even discussed.
That's why people need to go and buy your book and read it from cover to cover several times and absorb it and then apply that information to the other information that they've learned and add more pieces to this very strange jigsaw puzzle.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Keith Chester, I want to thank you for joining us. I look forward to reading your book, Strange Company Military Encounters with UFOs in World War II. It came out the last week of May 2007. I will put a link to the Amazon listing. I imagine it's also listed at the Anomalist website, too.
Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Earl, thank you very much for having me. Really appreciate it.
I really appreciate the amount of time and energy that you've put into your book, and obviously it adds much, much more to the public knowledge about UFOs over the years.
Thank you so much. I hope it's a worthy addition to the existing UFO literature, and it can help other researchers continue on.
I'm sure it shall. Nicely done, Keith Chester. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
It was good.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And as we do every couple of weeks, we head down to Enterprise, Alabama. Regular biweekly contributor Alfred Lemberg joins us on the line. Hello, Alfred. I guess that's in reference to Furlott and I talking about the Alabama fog whistle. Is that
right?
You thought you'd do it at the beginning this time?
Yeah. I was really at my best. I usually am for the inconsequential stuff.
You took the words right out of my mouth.
No. Yeah, see, that's what you pay me the good money for.
Yeah, that's why I'm paying you huge dollars to do this podcast.
Well, geez, what am I going to do with it all? Well, once again, you've reset your own bar there, Mr. Bruce Knapp.
Why would that be, Mr. A. Lemberg?
Well, another killer program. Absolutely killer. Keith Chester, and I had not heard of him before until just recently. He's just somebody that apparently has been working for years and years and years and is an overnight success.
Yeah, one of those independent researchers that we sometimes hear reference to.
Mm-hmm.
Very rarely. Independent researchers tend to keep their heads down below the internet level.
I know Frank Fascino, a similar kind of person doing a similar kind of thing, is a similar kind of way.
And of course, in no way does it negate the work that they do.
Oh, no, not at all. In fact, it probably helps. Nobody's in their business and distracting them and writing them letters and carrying on and going nutsoid.
Yeah, and it is good.
Keith Chester and His Strange Company is one of those books that seems to be popping up with some regularity now. Quality works. I'd already mentioned Frank Fascino in his Shoot Them Down, talking about the same era of time and generally pretty much the same stuff from two different directions, I think.
And one flows out of one era into another.
Yeah, true.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very impressed that Jerome Clark did the foreword for Strange Company. That's got to be significant and meaningful of something. I think if Jerome Clark's going to put his name on it, it's got to have some substance.
An imprimatur.
I would think.
Yes.
And it also, from what I understand, has Nick Redfern jumping up and down in its regard, too. He's also very impressed. And I appreciated also Keith Chester's admonition that all of those researches that he's been doing just scratch the surface. There's just so much stuff out there. I think a quote from him was that he could spend an entire lifetime just looking at the stuff and trying to catalog it and iterate it, you know?
Yeah, and that's only one tiny segment of the phenomenon.
Yeah. I was also very impressed that he seems to want to spread the lamp around. He didn't kind of insist on having every bit of it on himself. He allowed his how Jan Aldridge of Project 1947 and Barry Greenwood of the Sign Historical Group were primary sources, very conversant with the history and steering him in the correct way. So he was able to produce, I think, what is going to be a quality work when he gets to it.
Barry Greenwood and Jan Aldrich have always done amazing work. In fact, you may have noticed this month's username and password reflect my respect for Jan Aldrich and Project 1947.
Oh, very cool. I'd seen the email, but hadn't gone over there to open it yet. No, I got that to look forward to.
Yes.
But I appreciated the way he was pulling out names in history and seemed to be a very authoritative and very knowledgeable guy about this stuff. I know the book's going to be killer. What he had to say about Leonard Stringfield, probably the very first guy to get serious about crashed flying saucers, died in 1994. And I remember just pretty much after I had gotten started myself in looking at this stuff, I remember him passing and going, wow, Leonard Stringfield, I wonder who he was. These guys seem to be living on.
Yes.
Wonderful history about this stuff, though, isn't it? The way he was able to iterate it from the 30s through the 40s and what happened just after the war and who was involved in the different countries it's happening in. Pretty exciting stuff.
Yes, and doubtlessly for newcomers and maybe for people who've been around the field for a while, a little awareness of a lot of the detail that is in Keith Chester's book.
Really, and I'm glad he's taking the time to point it out to us, and I'm glad there's other people doing it from different directions like we'd already talked about. He brought up some interesting points, you know, and he's talking about the history through the 30s and how they were phantom flyers for a while, and then become ghost aircraft and ghost missiles and
ghost rockets, yeah.
Bright lights and beams of light and shafts of light and all of this stuff reported in the 30s. I think some of the technology needed to produce some of the lights described really weren't available then, were they?
No, and certainly a long time before LEDs and lasers.
You think so? That's some fascinating stuff. And then he brings out the point why in Freedom of Information Act and stuff like that, where we're trying to break loose some of this old information, he asks the question, you know, why is this stuff, this crazy, silly UFO stuff, it's 60 years and older, still classified?
And a damn good question, too.
Yeah. Well, he asked it. I think it deserves a little Klieg light of its own, and we have the technology now.
Mm-hmm.
Some other questions that he was asking. What is the rationalization of this silly clampdown using home security and 911 prerequisite as some kind of reason for keeping all this stuff under wraps from the National Archives through the Presidential Archives and into, well, where we need to go to get this information? You know, what's this 911 justification?
I don't know. 9/11 seems to have been used as an excuse for a lot of clampdowns in a lot of areas.
You betcha. And don't think it's not being noticed either.
Here are you and I and Keith Chester commenting on it.
I thought this was kind of classic, too. Our pilots, the people that are flying around with these bombs and guns and what have you, and flying around passengers and everything else, they're hallucinating.
Yes.
I love that. Don't worry about the pilot up there. He's only hallucinated twice this month on this particular run.
I guess that's an explanation on a par with swamp gas and Venus and.
Yeah, and don't think it's not being noticed either, you who are listening.
Funny, there's an echo in this podcast.
Yeah. His indications in his research is where these records, these requested records that he should be able to get by law, by Freedom of Information, these records are being moved around. They're being misfiled. They're being misleadingly titled. Strange stuff there.
Now, whether that's deliberate or not, we don't know. As Dave Clark said in last week's program, accidents happen. It's human beings working in the system, you know?
I recall Dr. Clark saying that, but I think the question needs to be asked also, is there evidence of similar misfilings in other subject areas with regard to something that you wouldn't want to cover up, that you wouldn't want to make hard to find or impossible to get to? Things with regard to boat safety or aviation procedure or disaster preparedness. What if you're researching things like that? I wonder if there are similar misfilings and misleading titles and records moved around where you can't find them.
There's a good idea for a FOIA request, huh? A Freedom of Information Act request for misfilings of files.
Yeah, Mr. Bryant, get on that, would you?
Can you imagine what that would cause and cost?
It would sure be interesting to find out that if it was something that you didn't have some real critical interest in, then it was required that it maintain some kind of a continuity, a reliability, if that's being misfiled and misnamed and moved around. And I don't think it would be. This harkens back to the same thing like, oh, gee, wasn't it just unfortunate, but oh, what a coincidence that all of that message traffic during Roswell just disappeared. Yeah. I mean, that's crazy. Come on, folks. You don't have to jump to a conclusion to get there. You know, there's no stretch there. Come on. It's a tight spot in history that everybody's interested in, and oh, what a surprise. The records are gone. You know, craziness.
I guess the question is, have other records, message traffic, disappeared from other air bases from that time?
That would be another question.
There's another FOIA question.
Mr. Bryant, you getting all this? Some of the other things that he mentioned where he's talking about commanding officers deliberately distorting the record, citations of that, to avoid talking about the crazy stuff that they knew was unnerving their pilots. What about that? That's a real eye-opener. And some interest, too, in it being described when he was talking about Foo Fighters. They were essentially reported as just a night phenomenon. And then he discredited that himself later on, you know, when he mentioned that, no, it was a day phenomenon, too.
There are a couple of photographs of Foo Fighters,
uh-huh.
one of which I recall being a daytime photo.
Me, too. And then I remember back to several years ago now, and I think I'd mentioned this once or written about it on the list, with regard to a childhood friend of the family, who was still living, by the way. Maybe I could give him a call and see if he'd be interested in talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of my father's that I'd known since I was a little bitty kid. He was telling the story about when he's flying against the Japanese in the South Pacific, and they're flying around between these islands, and he was involved with a firefight himself at the time when he noticed something silvery flying in an odd, abrupt, and erratic manner behind the aircraft during the firefight. You know,
wow.
That was all during the day. You know, that was a daylight sighting. And
yes,
stuff.
Yes.
But killer story, especially the way he told it. I got to see if, because we have the technology now, maybe I'll give him a call on the phone and see if I can get to talk to him about it for, you know, 10 minutes or so.
There's a nice idea.
Another thing that he was talking about that was very interesting with regard to the Foo Fighters is firing at them and the bullets not bouncing or ricocheting or anything, just being absorbed, or the Foo Fighter dodging the bullets and staying away from the bullets. Man, that's some startling stuff. And all the missing air intelligence information that I recall that Dr. Clark was very comfortable about just dismissing as boys being boys, you know.
I don't know that he necessarily really feels that way. I think it's just, rather than worry and mither and fret over it, he would just as soon let it go, because it's not going to do any good being concerned about it, you know. And not that I'm trying to make excuses for Dave Clark.
No, you're being the portrait of fairness that you are.
Thank God somebody is.
Another couple of things that he said, talking about Project Sign and really putting that into the history in a way that it wasn't before, when you consider it an extension of wartime Foo Fighter worries. It has a hook in a historical timeline that it didn't have before for me, you know, so I thought that was kind of cool. It was a killer interview about a book that I'm very interested in reading. If he's listening, hey, maybe you'd send me a review copy and I'll do a review of it.
And maybe even review it for UFO Magazine.
Oh, you betcha. That would be the first choice.
As the regular listener knows, Alfred Lemberg is a columnist at UFO Magazine.
And very happy over there, too, I might add. Those people have just been absolutely wonderful, and wonderful to me, and wonderful to the people that are around me, as far as I can see.
And they've been very kind to me, too.
Yeah, she's got kind of an interesting concept over there. And it's one that I heard before, and it was something that my father was kind of involved with when he was a young man, actually a lot younger than I am now. He was in a little acting troupe. They called themselves The Colony. And throughout the rest of my life, when that word comes up outside of its usual meaning, I kind of perk up, because it's obvious that these are people that are trying to associate it in a community for some good, some kind of artistic expression and contribution, you know. Nancy Burns is interested in this concept of colony and applying it to the magazine to have a colony of writers. Just kind of appeals to me. I like it. So moving on to Dave Frelott, I could title his segment, Furry Goes Bad on Bart. And didn't this guy deserve the Psychological Board Award for his contribution? Good God.
Mm-hmm.
SETI rules. Not. Dave really hit it on the head.
He did, he did.
I think he was as revolted as I am. The points that Eddie Bart, he's a professor or a Rhodes Scholar in physics, Dave Frelott was just so incredibly, almost poignant, about pointing out how woefully uninformed this guy was sounding and acting and pontificating, to the point where he was blowing a huge nose bubble and had no idea he was doing it.
And you find that most of these expertologists, which is a great expression, really have not a clue what it is that they're talking about outside their own field. They're complete bumbling idiots.
They just think they can talk because they have the degree. They have piled the feces higher and deeper, so nobody can tell them about anything. It doesn't matter that they're talking outside their field, like Dr. Nickel does for CSI anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to Eddie Bart now, the concept that we're alone, I don't know why anybody is remotely willing to even entertain that concept, given that this guy is a physicist and should have gotten somewhere along the line that concept that which can happen happens and doesn't happen only once. We happened. Humanity happened. Okay, that's it. That's the happening. You think we're alone and separate in the godless amounts of space-time and surface area that's out there for our considering and our imagining? How can anybody be that stupid, that non-artistic, that unbrave?
You're familiar with Murphy's Law?
Yes.
Which says if anything can go wrong, it will. Well, there's O'Leary's corollary to Murphy's Law.
Uh-huh. There you are.
Which says Murphy was an optimist. This man, Bart, in South Africa, is a classic example of Murphy's Law.
He's just got no imagination. Given the kinds of intelligence that have evolved right here on this planet, talking about three or four separate species of mankind that we know about, considering cetacea and whales and the intelligences, the strange alien intelligence that they might possess, octopus, squid, cuttlefish that speak in a language of light, which was something else that Dave brought up, was that, man, how arrogant to think that alien, the other, is going to speak in a language or a medium that you can understand, conceive of, or even perceive. He was just so right on. It's idiotic to stop this robotic exploration of space when we've learned so much and gone so far and elevated ourselves so much by what we have been able to perceive out in the solar system already. Come on.
I think for me, Dave Frelat said it all. There's really not much to add to it. The Barts of the planet keep puffing their head above the horizon.
He'll probably get a $200,000 grant to pursue this buffoonery, too.
Oh, they have to spend the money somewhere, and far be it from them to allocate funding to look into the things that we want looked into.
Yes, I'm certainly a lot more valid and a lot more productive and a lot more innovative and a lot more courageous stuff than those folks are willing to have a look at, I think, if I may be bold once again.
You are consistently bold and constantly going where every other human has been before.
Really?
Does the name Lara Braveheart mean anything to you?
Dieting for disclosure.
There you go.
Yes.
Good memory.
Yes.
She suddenly resurfaced this
really?
Morning. Sent me an email that she wanted passed on to Stephen Greer. I'll pass it on. Very strange, because I'd been thinking about her this past week, and suddenly up she popped.
I think about her now and again myself. And again, I have to admit, for the cheap shots that I may have appeared to be taking, I had no real disrespect for what she was doing. And anything that's going on that raises the consciousness of UFOs and gets people thinking about them, even if it's only for a slap and a tickle and a cheap little giggle sometimes, any publicity is good publicity, you know, trying to get this out into the AO. So I can't falter too much. I'll cut it short.
For those of you who didn't catch what Alfred said a few moments ago, he said, ah, yes, dieting for disclosure. And Lara Braveheart, for a long time, was dieting for disclosure. And I guess that was back, was that before the turn of this century?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that was like back maybe the 97 time frame,
97, 98.
She apparently lost about 45 pounds, too,
yeah.
By report. Who knows? I hope she's doing well, and I hope she's got a little story to tell. Did she want you to be quiet about the communication to Stephen Greer?
No, not one way or the other. And she included a link to a blog, which is totally bizarre, and dedicated to Timothy McVeigh.
A blog dedicated to Timothy McVeigh?
It appears that way. And she, I think, was in Paris, was supposed to meet someone, and was just totally pissed because they hadn't shown up.
Oh, well.
Curiouser and curiouser.
It's unfortunate that in this day and age, it's difficult to entertain conversation or even consideration for terrorists and their ilk, however they're motivated and however correct they may or may not have been. notice the derisive laughter at the end of that, folks, indicating that just having a little fun.
So an update on Lara Braveheart for those who knew and those who would like to find out more. You can go to the UFO Updates archive at virtuallystrange.net, and right on the front page there's a Google search facility, and just put Lara, L-A-R-A, Braveheart in there, and it will pop many posts by and about her. So what did you think about Paul Kimball's UFO's best evidence now that you've seen it?
The documentary just was, bottom line, the absolute best documentary I've ever seen on UFOs, bar none. I can't think of another one that really comes remotely close. Everything else is an also-ran. The reason that is not necessarily because Paul Kimball produced it. It's the lengths that he went to get it right the first time. I suppose not have to go back, or maybe ran this thing out in his mind so often that he was able to get rid of all of the things that could be criticized later on. It's obvious that he took his time to do it right, and I'm very appreciative that someone has done something like that about UFOs.
Yes. The DVD version, who knows when that will come out, but Paul's in the process of putting that together now, will contain an astonishing amount of stuff that, of course, you can't get in a so-called one-hour television documentary, which in reality is about 46 minutes or something, if that, 38 minutes maybe.
Actually, yes, and neatly taking care of the only criticism that I had with the film at all was that it was too short by a factor of three, I wrote, actually, as I recall.
The DVD will compensate for that, doubtlessly, and I'm sure, actually, given all the publicity that it's getting and going to get, once he announces that it's available, will do extremely well and will end up on many people's shelves.
Well, I'll tell you, best evidence is ufological sea change, if we let it.
That's Alfred Lemberg's review. Very short, very concise, and I want to thank you for your sterling contributions to this program.
Enjoy it. I'm honored.
As
I'll
meet
his name on here.
God, I can just hear your heels clicking and arms waving around. Alfred, thank you, sir. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Okay, dude. We'll see you later.
Yes, you will. Bye.
Most people think God will come from the sky, take away everything, make everyone high. But if you know what life is worth, you'll look for yours right here on earth. So now you see the light. Stand up for your rights.
Don't give up, don't give up.
Stand up for your rights.
Get up.
Stand up for your rights.
I trust that you, like me, learned more interesting stuff relating to UFOs from this program. My thanks to Dave Forlot, Keith Chester, and Alfred Lemberg for adding to our collective knowledge. And we would like to hear from you, sdi@virtuallystrange.net. You can either send an email or attach an audio file that can be included in this program. Again, that's sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Till next week.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again next Saturday for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.